Welcome to the Payments Journal Podcast. And here is your host, Ryan Mack.
Welcome to the Payments Journal Podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Mack. Now, I want to start off today's episode with a little thought experiment. Now, imagine you are a customer shopping in-store or online, and you spend time browsing and filling your cart, and you get to the checkout and your card gets declined. Are you a happy customer at that point? Chances are one or two things are going to happen. Either you're willing to give it another try with a different card, and that could spell trouble for issuers who are looking to be top of wallet, or you're going to abandon your cart and go elsewhere, and that's really not good for the issuer or the merchant. Now, what can be more frustrating as a consumer is you know you are a good customer and you know you have the funds to make the purchase, but you're still denied anyways. Or as we call it in the payments industry, you experience a false decline. Now, false declines are no small deal and they have many ripple effects. So to talk about what merchants and issuers can do to combat false declines, I have Arjun Kakkar, who is the VP of Strategy at Ekata, and Tim Sloan, who is the VP of Payments Innovation at Mercator Advisory Group. Now, there's certainly a lot of great insights to take away from today's episode, so without any further delays, let's start the show. So Arjun and Tim, thank you so much for joining me on today's episode, where we're going to be taking a look at dynamic identity data decisioning. Certainly a little bit of a tongue twister there, but certainly a very important topic to discuss here today. Now, Arjun, I'm really glad that we've got you on today's episode, because I know that your organization has been able to provide us with this really great chart that's taking a look really at kind of false decline rates here, and taking a look at the revenue loss to false declines. And for those of you who are following along on paymentsjournal.com, you're going to be able to view this chart in the article below. So Arjun, perhaps you could kind of unpack this chart for our audience and kind of explain the significance around it.
First of all, Ryan, thanks for having me. This chart, it compares the cost of online fraud against the total revenue lost if you decline a good customer because of fraud. Now, what happens there is that the total global cost of fraud, as you see in this chart, in 2019 was about $30 billion. And that was the total amount of money lost to fraud. But if you compare that with the total lost value from declined users that were actually good users, it's 10x the number. So it's like a staggering $300 billion plus. Now, if you are running a digital business, you should care a lot about this, as I'm sure you do. It means that a business that focuses so much, and this is what businesses are doing today for various reasons, but if you focus too much on reducing fraud, you do end up losing out on good customers. And of course, when you decline a good customer, you don't just lose out on that transaction or whatever the customer would have given you at that moment. You lose out on the entire lifetime value of that customer. And it also leads to things like negative word of mouth. They'll tell you that, hey, I was buying something over here, or I was opening an account with this bank, but I got declined and I got frustrated and left. And the money you spent, of course, in acquiring the customer, that's also enough of a cost for your marketing team. I should note that this is not just true for card fraud, but it's also true for all online interactions, including things like bank account opening. Or opening a credit card account. You might ask at this, Ryan, that why is it such a big number? The fact is that this is a global phenomenon, but just to understand some of the differences, some of the points about this, and why is it such a big number, let's look at online commerce in the US. And I'm sure you shop online, Ryan, but do you just want to check with you, like, when was the last time you went shopping in a physical store? I'm sure you did that.
Oh boy, geez, that I gotta rack my brain a little bit on that one there.
March maybe?
yeah, probably, to be completely honest. It probably was back in March.
Yeah, and then, but in just your history of going to a physical store, how often do you think you ever had your card declined?
I can say that I think maybe it's happened once in my lifetime.
And then what about online?
Ooh, online. I don't think it's ever I can honestly think of one time where it happened online when I went to go purchase something that was a cross-border payment.
Great. So, you know, what generally happens to people, and if you actually look at data from MasterCard, while over 97-98% of in-person transactions are actually authorized, issuing banks end up authorizing only about 80 to 85%, around 83% is what MasterCard says, of online transactions. And, you know, especially if you're doing those cross-border things or if you're buying across geographies, that number is a staggering big number. And generally what would happen is that if the percentage of, so if you're declined, you know, you're looking at around 97-98% in physical, like in person, and around 80-85% in online, that difference of around 15-odd%, only around, how much of that is fraud? You cannot have 15% fraud, right? So just on the basis of our analysis and what we've seen in the market, the falsely declined transactions could be anywhere between 20-70%. But then, so you imagine 20-70% of those 15% you're declining are good customers. And if you decline a good customer, about a third of them are not likely to come back to you. And that sounds, you know, if you think about the churn rate and all the money you lose because of declining a good customer, and that's the reason why it's that 10x difference. And I think everyone in a digital business should care about that.
Yeah, false declines are certainly a major problem for merchants. And in fact, they're also a major problem for issuers because the same problems happen to the issuer. If I'm falsely declined using my issuer's card, I go to another card in my wallet and I may not go back. So the loss to either the merchant or the issuer is huge.
And you, Tim, you bring about such a good point that there's also, it's not just the merchant, it's also the card you use, right? There's this thing of what's the card on the top of your wallet. And if there is any card that you end up getting too many declines on, you move that to the back and the issuer is losing out.
Yeah, I'll share with you that a while back, I did a Payments Journal article about a card that I had in my wallet that was declining me over and over again. And so I cut it up.
Yeah. So I think it's a good decision. And I think most consumers would take a decision like that.
Right.
Yeah. And what kind of surprised me there is I think that you kind of brought up the whole one third in terms of not coming back to that particular merchant if their card is declining. To me, honestly, I'm going to be completely honest. I feel that number might be a little bit low, especially when looking towards a younger generation, towards Generation Z or millennials themselves, because I can't speak for the entire millennial generation, but I certainly think on my side of things, from my personal experiences, that the couple of times that, hey, it's been declined, there's almost kind of that, like, it sticks in the back of your brain. And although you may sit there and say, hey, it's not necessarily the merchant's fault, it might not necessarily be the issuer's fault, but there certainly is that kind of hey, I'm a legitimate customer. I know I am. I'm trying to give you money and you're telling me no. And it almost kind of sticks in the back of your brain a little bit. And there's almost kind of that little of vengeance of just kind of, all right, well, then I'm just not going to continue to shop with you on that aspect. So I think that, again, you bring up that one third. And to me, it kind of shocked me as just like that potentially might be a little bit lower towards, younger generations here, just being that they are so online focused. And there's certainly a slew of options that are available to them of, okay, hey, it was declined here. Well, I'm just going to go to the next merchant that has that product available for me and test it there and go through there for it. But let's kind of move away from the negative side of things and kind of take a look at more of a little bit of the positive side of things. So one of the things that I really want to kind of get into a little bit is that there's kind of just the different type of elements that can be used here, and that's really kind of static and dynamic elements. And obviously, you know, kind of off the tip of the iceberg here, obviously you can see static or elements or static things are things that don't move, and dynamic or things that can change. But beyond that, let's go a little bit deeper into what exactly that means in terms of static versus dynamic identity elements.
Great question, Ryan. So to answer that question, it's, you're trying to reduce false decline. So how do you do that? It's good to think about defining digital identity, and there are different definitions. So the way we at Ekata think about digital identity is as a collection of attributes that are true and useful for verifying a real world identity. So these attributes could be, again, static or dynamic, and they actually become almost two schools of different schools of thought in verifying if people are who they say they are online. You could start with dynamic, or let's start with static elements. This is the historical school of thought, and which basically tries to get a definite answer to validating identities. So they will say that, you know, this camp would say that, let's use something like government issued identifiers like social security number or photo IDs, etc., to find out, to say that, okay, if you are, you, if everything matches, then you are definitely that person that you said you are online. Generally, these identifiers are very country specific. Even things like age, which is something which increments by one, but you can't change it, right? Like, it's your birth date is static. They are usually, but the government piece of it, like SSN, are country specific. They are provided by bureaus. They may even exist. They may not even actually exist in some of the countries. Another thing to note there is these static elements are often compromised in data breaches. So if you think about the number of times your or my data, like any of our data, would have been compromised, including social security numbers, I can tell you at least 4 or 5 times in the last 4 or 5 years, just in my case, on the number of times I've been notified of it. But if you look on the other side, the new school of thought utilizes dynamic identity elements like the kind of Ekata provides. It's things like phone, email, address, IP information. And all of these, what this camp believes is that you can never get to a perfect or a definite answer. You can never say surely, like, this is Tim Sloan online. They say that we can only get to a probabilistic answer. So they rely on what's called probabilistic risk assessment as opposed to deterministic in the case of static elements. What is worth noting about dynamic elements is that they are difficult to assemble globally in a very normalized, consistent way, because they are, they come from places where the data is not as clean as in like a list of SSNs lined together. Putting them together in this consistent way is one of the hard problems that Ekata has done. The magic of these dynamic elements is that it's not just the linkages. Think of a graph between a person there and their email, phone, IP, and address, and then connected to other people. So if you cohabitate with someone, you would be connecting through the address in that graph structure. So the linkages are important, but not just that. There are other elements like metadata related to these elements, the history of the elements, the usage patterns of these elements all come together to give rich information that helps you really say whether this person is who they say they are online.
Yeah, and I would argue that that issue about probabilistic is really critical. In other words, you're trying to reduce friction. You're trying not to give a false positive and make the client go away. And the way to do that and to reduce friction is to have a probability that that individual is who they claim to be, and therefore give them access to low risk environments. If all they're trying to do is look at a balance, then go ahead and let them in as long as the risk is reasonably low. Then if they try to do a $100 transaction, you might want to be more careful. A $10,000 transaction, you better really dig in and do some authentication to make sure that individual is who they claim to be.
And Tim, like you, the way you described it is literally the whole idea of probabilistic risk assessment, right? Like you evaluate how risky it is to get this person or authorize them to or let them use your service, and to what extent am I ready to take the risk. And sometimes the risks are low. Like very often, for example, on e-commerce platforms, you'll be able to sign in without much friction because the real risk happens at the transaction level, right? Like when you're buying something. On the other hand, if you're joining a marketplace where the product is the marketplace, and you know, you're getting access to quite a lot of information by joining a marketplace, they will be a little more careful about what they call trust and safety issues. So they'll put a little more friction on you. But even there, they try to put it in a progressive way such that they'll put low friction to start with. And then you come in, and as soon as you want the next layer of services, they'll start progressively asking you or put more friction and ask more information. But at the same time, they might see patterns of behavior in which they will see get more confidence, and they might not put that friction on you. Same goes for banking. I can continue on examples from every industry, but you perfectly described how the most sophisticated players are starting to use data and provide and put less friction on the customers.
And that adds to your point, because if you're not moving to a probabilistic approach, your competitors are. And so exactly. It puts you at a disadvantage.
Exactly. And you're not a monopoly, right? Like you are in a competitive marketplace of others trying to. The one common thing in the industry today is that everyone is trying to give good customer experiences and trying to instill consumer trust and customer trust. And the one negative thing that happens with the biggest negative thing that happens with false decline is, if you don't trust me, I don't trust you. this speaks to what exactly Ryan was saying, right? Like, I'm actually, yeah, 33% seems low. It is a bigger number.
Yeah. And so, I mean, kind of really listening to all that, I mean, the two things that I'm really kind of pulling out of there, and I think that there's more to it here, but I'm really kind of hearing that with especially the dynamic identity elements here, the two things really of value that I pulled from there was kind of really just the reducing the friction and then also the customer experience side of things. But I feel that there's more value that certainly can be gained in possibly, you know, we could talk about that a little bit more. That really kind of comes from combining linkages, the metadata that you were talking about, and the usage patterns. And then maybe if we could, then we could, after we kind of, you know, answer that, we could kind of focus then on how dynamic identity elements really kind of make all of that possible.
Sure. So let me talk about that. I use these terminology level elements. It's worth talking a little bit about it. There are linkages. For example, there are connections between elements. So name to email, name to address, etc. That makes sense, of course, in a graph structure. If you think about metadata, is any additional data linked to an identity element? And this could be whether a particular email is valid or not, or whether a particular phone number is valid or not, or is this a voice over IP phone number? All of those pieces of information are risk signals. And finally, usage patterns are essentially observing the online behavior of identity elements in the network. So you could figure out the email first seen date. When is the last time you saw this phone and email together? These are all on, of course, Ekata's network, which has Ekata's over 1,700 customers globally. So it's a really big network with over 8 billion entities and billions of transactions on the network. So the value of that anonymized, of course, network being able to give you these usage patterns is very valuable. So I believe the value comes in true linkage between or using a combination of these linkages, metadata, and usage patterns to form this multidimensional view, if you will, that will give you insights on online transactions. So let me illustrate that with an example. So I mentioned this thing about email first seen in the usage patterns. What's interesting about it is that about 91% of consumers retain the same email over 3 years. So they will retain it for a long enough time. And only 3% of the emails or the email accounts are less than a year old. So very small percentage. I mean, and if you look back with yourself, what are the emails that you use online? And you'll see that they tend to be emails that you've created a while back. So email is a dynamic, but somewhat of a semi-static element, right? Like, and what the charm about the most valuable signals is that they are dynamic, but they should not be changing every minute, because then their value decreases. But this becomes a very good risk signal, because if you actually see if you take all the online transactions and you see how many emails, and you take all the emails over there, several of them would have been created in the last few days. And that is actually a risk signal. And that's more potentially a fraud, because that's for the fraudster. The fraudster wants to deliver something to themselves, like to an email, or deliver something to an address, or even a phone number, like an SMS to a phone number. And they would at least change one of these elements and make them their own. Ekata is able to find those risk signals. So this was just an example, but there are tons of these signals in our data, which are helpful for figuring out fraud. But more importantly, if you imagine, for example, in the email story, anything that is, if you have an email that is longer than a certain time period, like more than 365 days old, like more than a year old, you should say that this is very likely to be a good customer. Of course, combined with other identity elements that show that you are also low risk. And then it should be, that should be the case, what Tim was saying, that this customer should go through a low friction experience. And that's the charm of using dynamic identity elements.
Which is a lot faster, easier, and more convenient than having to be authenticated, where you're asked to identify a one-time password or some password that you've entered previously. Being able to lower the bar helps the consumer make more purchases.
Exactly. And you know, there might be, you do put successive levels of friction on customers if you do find them risky, and align with what you were saying earlier, Tim. You know, if you want them to take a picture of their ID card, etc., you do that, but you certainly don't do it with all your customers. And to identify which ones to do that or not, the dynamic identity elements are very helpful.
Totally agree.
Also, the one part that I didn't mention, which is also very valuable, is to you can use the dynamic identity data to find customers you might be able to falsely decline. But to do that, you can also do advanced methods like machine learning. So besides providing the risk signals like the email one that I said, or phone related signals that I talked about, Ekata also has several machine learning based risk scores that our customers use for figuring out whether people are who they say they are. The value of these scores is that Ekata has internally, we have taken the outcome data from our customers. So our customers give us back their data, and we have trained the models based on that data, and we give a prepackaged score that gives the power of all of our identity elements in these scores. And we don't have just one score, we have several scores. There is one called our transaction risk score, which validates things like linkages and metadata. Our identity network score, as it is named, tells you it gives you the risk against the usage of these identity data online. And combining these scores, our customers who don't want to build their own machine learning models are able to find good customers much faster. And we've seen examples, like in one particular case, a customer actually used both of these elements together. So, you know, what they found was that if a fraudster had at least one of the two elements, that is the identity risk score or identity network score, to be high. But if they had low scores for both of them, then it was almost certain that this customer was a good customer. And they found that of the rejected transactions, 20% of the transactions were that they were declining were actually good customers, and which were in the zone that Ekata said had low scores on both identity network as well as the transaction risk score. And that is the value of, and you can imagine that 20% translating to, in this case, it was going to close to $1 million. And that's real value coming with these scores.
Sure, depending on average ticket, that can be a lot of money.
Exactly.
You know, if we can, I want to bring this conversation really full circle here. So Arjun, at the beginning of our conversation, you know, you talked about kind of the $300 billion plus in lost revenue due to false declines here. Now, obviously, at Ekata, you have access to a lot of great data and therefore insights from that. So maybe you could kind of pull out some of the great insights that you're able to share with our audience from the data that you see when it comes to false declines.
I think it's very much in line with what we have been talking about. The biggest value of this data is when you look at data, you should not be looking at it just from one side of it. Think of it as a spectrum, and any identity data element on one side will say this is risky, but if you go, there'll be a whole zone in which there'll be a gray zone. So for example, in the email example that I was saying, that if you see that an email was created in the last 7 days, that's risky. If you see anything that is over 365 days, so about a year, you can say, and you know, the range might vary for different, you usually would have to test it. You would say, this is very safe. So these are all good customers. And somewhere in the middle is the gray zone. But the fact that there are two ends of this distribution for almost every element, and you can imagine if you combine them together to write rules or put in your data science models, you get tremendous value out of it. You know, data is extremely powerful. It allows us to dive deep into very basic identity elements. And you know, it's never, I always think of it as it's not really a silver bullet. You'll never find a silver bullet like the one or two examples that I've been giving you. It is a very complicated task, but the best way to do it well is get access to good data, because that's what the fraudsters are doing. Actually, the fraudsters are amassing a ton of data using data breaches, and it's about time the good guys start doing it too.
Indeed, within the payments infrastructure, we have a race to see who can get the most data and the most reliable data to be able to help with fraud management, fraud decisions. So it is all about the data.
That's right, Tim.
Excellent. So Arjun, Tim, thank you so much for taking the time today for speaking to me about dynamic identity data decisioning. And I hope to have both of you back on the podcast real soon.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Arjun.
Thanks, Tim.